Hi there, I'm Amy Griffiths and I'm one of the journalists in Manx Radio's newsroom and you're listening to Newscast.
So I'm Dr. Martin Rankin, I'm a GP on the island and I'm this year's president of the Isle of Man Medical Society. Well, while constitutional questions fall outside the Medical Society's remit, we can't ignore the strength of feeling expressed by the patients. Many people believe that major decisions affecting the island should be determined here by the Manx electorate. And a referendum held alongside the next general election would ensure that broad participation was possible and give the community a chance to actually speak on this issue.
There was the idea of a referendum that was put forward in Tynwald by the Chief Minister, if I remember rightly, that was not supported by politicians. So, I mean, that's not something that's going to be a viable option ahead of the next election in, what, 5 months are we away now? Yeah, 5 months.
So I struggle with any concept of too much democracy. If this matter is really important, it's really fundamental, and effectively this is being decided by a small group of politicians who weren't elected with a manifesto saying that if you vote for X party, we will introduce this legislation. They were elected for their broad capabilities as politicians. They're taking it upon themselves to make this legislation, which is highly controversial. The limited public engagement that was entered into on it showed actually a small majority of people were not in favour of the legislation. So it seems to be pushing forward an agenda which is popular with a small group of people, but I think actually is very concerning for the impact it could have on lots of other people. What you need to understand is that between a quarter and a third of people will spend months or years in long-term care, often at great personal cost. By contrast, only a very small minority ever face symptoms that modern palliative care can't control. And that imbalance matters, because when somebody knows that years in a care home could wipe out most of what they hope to leave their children, that creates a powerful and often an unspoken pressure. And any assisted dying law must confront that head on. So we need much stronger safeguards. We need independent oversight and we need rigorous capacity assessments. We hear very clearly that many people believe decisions of this scale should be made by the Manx electorate, potentially through a referendum at the next general election. And really, this shouldn't be a decision that the politicians exclude the public from.
Well, Dr. Allinson, who was the politician who moved the bill in the first place, he argues that a lot of those extra safeguards were going to be coming through in the secondary legislation. So I suppose now they're going to have to accelerate that and do that quicker. But are there any changes that could be made to the bill in its current form that might make the society more comfortable with it?
The overwhelming sentiment from doctors on the island is that the bill is unnecessary. So rushing through changes at this stage to get this through in this sitting of Tynwald strikes me as ill-advised, and it would certainly be fair to say it's against the advice of doctors that we pass this legislation at all.
You talked a little bit about it there, but the Society said in the statement that it believes that true compassion lies in the enhancement of palliative care services. So what kind of improvements would you like to see in that area here on the Isle of Man?
So we already have fairly good palliative care services on the Isle of Man, and I would say that they're broadly comparable to those in most parts of Britain and probably way ahead of the rest of the world. But you can always do more with more, can't you?
My name's Graham McCall. I'm a retired GP and I'm part of Manx Duty of Care, which is an informal grouping of health and social care workers who have been opposing this bill from the beginning.
And that's probably quite a good place to start in terms of why you are opposed to the bill.
I think the fundamental reason for our opposition to the bill is coercion of the vulnerable and socially deprived. And a lack of real choice for them, that actually, we're worried that coercion can be so hidden and so subtle, and it can even be self-coercion, that actually helping people through their suicidal ideas is so much more important to protect them from those than, you know, than to helping them to proceed. So that's our real concern is the vulnerable, and we see in Holland and, you know, a disproportionate number of autistic people, you know, going for it, and we see in Canada, the report from Ottawa shows that people who are socially deprived and women more likely go for it. So it's so we really feel, you know, there is, it's been shown in other jurisdictions to be not safe, even with really, you might say, really good independent reviews. I mean, Holland has independent reviews. So you would have thought that it would be much safer than it is. But, you know, so one might prevent suffering for a few near the very end of life, the few who, for whom palliative care doesn't work. And yet we might, and yet we'll be committing, you know, others. Others will suffer. Lives will be needlessly shortened. We can't give good, decent prognoses. We for 6 months, a year, we're getting it wrong all the time. Look at Esther Anson. I mean, it's just incredible. So, yeah, so it's a real, there's lots and lots of concerns.
And the coercion side of things as well is something, is one of the three main points that the Ministry of Justice came back on, yes, that it wanted a bit more clarity on, particularly about whether or not it's going to comply with the European Convention on Human Rights. And so what exactly, or I suppose actually better question is there anything that could be changed about the bill that would make you feel more comfortable with it?
Well, anything which makes the bill safer, of course, is good, but we fundamentally, we don't think this can be made really safe. And people have tried all over the world to make their bills really safe. And we think it's going to fundamentally change the relationship between doctors and social care workers and their patients. It's going to take away the trust. It's going to change the whole nature of the health service. So, yeah, we think, yeah, it'd be great if we could eliminate coercion, be fantastic, but can we do it? We don't think you can, and we don't think you can train people to adequately assess for coercion either. It's not something doctors are good at, even in the first place.
The MOJ did say that it should not be interpreted as disallowing royal assent, yes, was I think quite a key sentence, and arguably our politicians have voted in favour of progressing, yes, the bill, and these changes, and the bill, by the sounds of it, if these changes are made, will continue to progress. So do you feel like there could be any way of this bill not going through, or are we too far into it now?
I think Dr. Anson should be really embarrassed that he's worked so hard on this bill, and yet it's shown to be so fallible, and despite the assurances of the Attorney General's office, you know, it doesn't comply with the European Convention on Human Rights, which is basic government protections of our lives. It's not as if European Convention is some high standard which nobody's ever going to reach. This is basic fundamental protection of our lives. And, you know, Article 2 guarantees that protection of our lives. And the issue there is that supposing you have people with disability, you know, our Capacity Act isn't constructed to help people make life and death decisions like this. It's not, the protections are not going to be there even when, once we've implemented and trained everybody in the Capacity Act. It's a big problem. So Dr. Hansen should really withdraw the bill and admit that it's just so complicated. Hours and hours and hours of civil service and MHK time, expensive time, has been spent on this. And the hospice, meantime, is crying out for funding. Two of my friends died last year with less than perfect care, and it would have been much better care if the hospice had been adequately funded. And it isn't. What we should do is, well, minimum, we should, you know, everyone who gives a pound to the hospice, the government should match it with a pound. We should have a 50-50. Everyone would understand what that is, rather than sort of, what, 25% the government funds it at the moment? And yet they're proposing to fund 100% of death service. I mean, what choice is that, really? That's a real worry. So, yeah, the big positive from this is, come on, let's admit we haven't got hospice care sorted out. Let's get this bill... Let's consign this bill to the bin where it really should be, and get hospice care sorted out first, really support each other in those painful, painful, painful moments was a GP, you know, I've witnessed near the end of life. But most people, by far the majority of people, really can achieve a good death, as we are at the moment. But let's work harder and support each other, these tragic and difficult moments.
And of course, we are coming to the end of this current administration. With this delay, there could be a very real chance that it's deferred to the next administration, the incoming administration. Are you hoping that that could potentially kick it into the long grass almost and see it fall by the wayside? Do you think there's any chance
of
that?
Well, obviously, I think it would. I have to say, we think it would be a good thing if that happened. I don't know the technical, you know, possibilities really about that. So one other big disadvantage this bill has had is that it has been a private member's bill. So the UK government didn't get to scrutinise it before the final bill was submitted. There's another thing which is perhaps more fundamental, which I noticed, and I'm not a parliamentarian, but and I'm so impressed with our politicians, the difficulties that they have to deal with. And, you know, the complexity of the issues that they're trying to tackle, you know, huge admiration for them. But one thing I noticed in the debates was a lot of our politicians were actually on their phone or their tablet while somebody was speaking. They weren't actually listening to each other. This is agonizing. This is, and what are they getting? They're probably getting messages from outside the Isle of Man, perhaps not even Manx people. This is, democracy is really in danger if we're not listening to each other in the debating chamber. This is a huge, huge thing. The Chief Minister gave such a powerful speech on the referendum, and I could see some people were not listening. They were looking at their tablets. They weren't actually listening to his speech. I couldn't believe it. His speech was so moving, it had me in tears, and so powerful. And yet you could see that quite a few of the members weren't actually listening. This was agonising. I mean, this is fundamental to our democracy. We elect these people to listen to each other, to have these great debates, but they shouldn't be on their phones in the chamber. This is terrible. It's, and so that's a minor point, but, you know, that affects all our legislation. We are being influenced by outside campaigning organisations, you know, in all sorts of ways, and they've really got to be independent.
But this has gone through the House of Keys.
Yes.
It's gone through the Legislative Council.
It
it's progressed its way through our political system in the way that it should have done.
It has.
Is there not a point at some point where you have to accept that is what is going to happen?
Listen, this is a democracy and we all respect the rule of law. So if something becomes law, then, of course, we should respect it. And we should work with the government as best, you know, that's, we all have to work together as a community, and we need to, despite divisions, we need to be able to chat to each other, and we need to cross these things. We need to prevent social media polarization and all the awful things that are happening now. We need to, it's such a fantastic place to live, isn't it? What a wonderful island we live on. And, you know, and it's our shared home. You know, we have to work together. We can't, you know, it's, we have to do it. But of course, until that moment that something becomes law, well, you know, fight tooth and nail for you know, for it to, you know, for it. And I have a real sense that, you know, as a GP, if I had a patient who was suicidal, which is a terrible situation to be in, and I've been in that, I've had patients in that situation many times. And of course, what they need at those moments is protection. And here we are. I slightly feel, yeah, you know, come on, Isle of Man, let's not be suicidal. You know, that basically the UK is actually, we're a crown protectorate. The crown is actually, funnily enough, trying to protect us from ourselves. It's a strange, strange situation to be in. It's a sort of strange parallel, you know.
Hi, my name is Sue Biggerstaff. It's because my husband had motor neurone disease and other complications such as a twisted bowel. It was really about the end, though. It was, he had a very aggressive form of MND, and he was paralysed from the neck down within 2 months. And eventually, he developed what we thought was a bed sore, and this just got worse and worse and worse. And Simon was in so much pain. And what I was eventually told is that his body was decomposing while he was still alive. So in the end, the whole of his backside had pretty much gone and he just had open flesh. So despite having a driver in each arm and each leg delivering pain relief, as well as a cocktail of drugs going through a peg in his stomach, they couldn't stop the pain. He had to sit up because otherwise he would have choked, couldn't breathe. So he had to sit on this and he did eventually ask the doctor if he could have his food stopped. But that takes a month for you to die of starvation, but that is perfectly legal. You can do that, even though it would have been me stopping his food. How this is right, I'll never know. Sadly, he died 2 weeks later. But those last 2 weeks, he shouldn't have had to endure. Nobody should have had to endure it. I mean, there was problems, lots of problems before then. But those last 2 weeks, when he kept saying, make it stop, we should have been able to make it stop and we couldn't. And the fact he'd chosen to starve shows how bad it was.
And I'm just so sorry that that was something that you both had to go through and that he had to live through. And all of that history then makes this news even more emotive, I suppose, for you.
When I first heard, I'll be honest, I burst into tears. And I feel like every delay means more people are going to suffer and more families like mine are going to have to watch their loved ones suffer, which is just, it's horrible. But since receiving the news, I've been led to believe that this is not the end and that hopefully our government can work with the adjacent aisle and get this through, because I've been across and I have met so many people with terminal illnesses who have told me their stories. I've stood alongside them outside Westminster and seen them fighting, knowing it's going to be too late for them. Two of them that I met have already passed away. But these are terminally ill people fighting for people in the future who will be terminally ill. And listening to their stories as well as Simon's story, you know, it's just awful. And I really don't understand why our government, you know, our parliament, voted this in. It was the will of the people. It went through. And then we have to rely on royal assent from over there. And I know it's because we're a crown dependent, but it seems so wrong that ourselves, Wales, Jersey, we've all done this. And I can't help but think that the English didn't want this to go through before theirs did. And maybe that's wrong, but if it's true, I've been here 40 years and in this current moment in time, I'm ashamed to be English.
What the Ministry of Justice has said is that there were certain issues with the bill that it just wanted a bit of clarity on. So it wanted to make sure that it's complying with the European Convention on Human Rights. So things around the capacity, things about coercion, those kind of elements. And do you think that those are the kind of things that should be put in place first, or do you think they're actually more helpfully tackled during the secondary legislation process, as is currently the case?
To be fair, my understanding, and I sat through every debate when this was going through, my understanding was that it was airtight. Clearly, this has arisen. I can't really understand it, because I do remember thinking that even if it came in place because of the strict legislation they'd put in, Simon himself, because he was paralysed from the neck down, wouldn't have been able to administer his own drugs. So I must admit, I was gobsmacked when I heard this. And obviously, I agree the legislation should be right. But if it was going to be in secondary legislation, I really can't see what difference it makes. What's important was getting this bill through and stopping people suffering and giving people that choice. A lot of people don't take the choice There's 250 million people across the world this is already available to. Less than 1% take it up. But the fact it's there can give them some sort of peace of mind that they're not going to have to suffer as Simon did at the end. And as I say, I've spoken to people who are terminally ill. I'm not a politician. I can't comment too much on all the ins and outs. But in my view, I thought it was airtight. And I know people worry about coercion, but if I remember correctly, there's got to be two independent doctors and a psychiatrist. The precautions were there. And in the secondary legislation, there was more, but I'm sure that that was already in the first one. But I'm afraid it's Dr. Allenson there. It's a year ago to me now, and I was so happy when it went through, thinking that people like Simon wouldn't have to go through what he did. And that's why I fought for it. And I'm just gutted with the whole thing. I'm just praying that we can still get it sorted.
Well, the MOJ did say that their findings shouldn't be interpreted as disallowing royal assent. Yes. But are you worried that this hurdle is going to drag out the process so much that it now doesn't happen, especially with a new administration incoming in, you know, less than 6 months now?
I am worried about that, and the constant filibustering in the House of Lords delaying the English one. I think the general play is to delay it until it all runs out of time. And sadly, if it does, the whole process will have to start again. I can only hope that our current government and any new government will operate with compassion and fight to get this law through, this bill through. The one thing I try and say at the end of every interview is what a lady said to me in a demo, and that was, no human being has the right to tell another human being how long they could and should suffer. And I think that one sentence says it all, and that's what this bill is about. And I have said it before, if I kept an animal alive in the same way that Simon was, I'd be prosecuted. And how can it be against the law to treat an animal like this and treat a human being is legal? That's not right.
It's Rob Callister, MHP for Onken. Well, I think initially we should note that England and Wales are struggling with this piece of legislation themselves. At the moment, their draft bill is currently in the House of Lords. And I think, if I remember right, it had over 1,000 amendments. So I'm not surprised that the UK government is a little nervous around this piece of legislation. As I said right at the very outset of this debate back in May 2022, when my colleague from Ramsay, Dr. Allenson, was moving that private members bill, I genuinely believe that, you know, we should have taken a steer towards the Jersey model, which was one accepted by the government very early on. They had a jury system that actually had a cross-section of their community look at the legislation. But more importantly, they brought together both the primary and the secondary legislation, which gave every single island resident in the Channel Islands an understanding, not just how the primary legislation would be drafted, but how the model would work in operational in technicalities in respect of safeguarding protection and how the service would be rolled out to the community. The Isle of Man didn't do that, unfortunately.
And that's the thing that the MOJ has said, isn't it? It's not that it should be interpreted as disallowing royal assent, but actually it just wants to make sure that the bill's complying with the European Convention on Human Rights, and that actually purely the primary legislation without the secondary legislation doesn't give them that assurance.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting question for the future, that if we're bringing something which the rest of the British Isles is looking at, is that we try to bring forward a piece of legislation which maybe in the future requires that secondary legislation in order for everybody to understand what is going to be achieved. For me personally, I always thought the primary legislation was only the first hurdle. And then after that, the secondary legislation would have to be drafted. The people of the Isle of Man would have to get that information. There would be a further consultation on the Isle of Man for the Isle of Man as a collective group to either accept or reject assisted dying on the Isle of Man. The primary legislation is just the first of many hurdles to overcome.
I suppose the issue as well is that sometimes, and I could imagine in this case, the secondary legislation can take an awfully long time. I mean, there are some bills that have been approved for years and years and they still haven't got the secondary legislation through yet. And so actually for something like this, where particularly it's such a contentious issue and one that people want to make sure is right, it could make that process take so much longer.
Yeah, and if you go back to the second reading in October 2023, I made that point very clearly. I personally wanted to see us take that route that Jersey followed. They had a multi-year approach. And then from that, they were confident that, one, that it was supported by the Channel Islands collectively, but which enabled the government then to get behind the bill. So the Jersey's draft legislation has the full weight of government behind it. This in the Isle of Man is a private member's bill, and it still has to overcome those hurdles that trying to get, one, the public to accept it, but also trying to get the professionals to get into accepting this as well. So there's a lot of hurdles still to come. This is obviously stalled now, and I think two things have got to happen when something like this happens again in the future, that we do on the Isle of Man allow secondary legislation to be drafted at the same time to give everybody the full picture. But more importantly, that maybe we should again look at those citizens' juries to see, once the public is on side, then government can be confident enough to get behind it, because that is what the Isle of Man's asking for. From that point of view, it's purely about rolling out the operational functions around that bill.
And do you think it raises questions, this issue, about just how much involvement the UK can have in Manx legislation, essentially, and being able to block it?
I think, to be perfectly honest, it's very rare for the UK government to interfere with legislation being passed here on the Isle of Man. Clearly, they've got their own concerns around the assisted dying legislation themselves. And I understand why they're a little nervous, because at the moment, the legislation in Scotland is slightly different than the Isle of Man. The Isle of Man is slightly different than Jersey, and Jersey is different than England and Wales. So at some point, it was always my understanding, at some point, once the legislation had been passed in all the legislatures in the British Isles, there would be some coming together of the legislation, and there would be one uniform sort of piece of legislation right across the British Isles. But obviously, because we are crown dependencies, and then you have England and Wales as well, and you have Scotland as a devolved parliament, each of them are doing it slightly different, depending on what their community is asking for.
Thank you for making it to the end of the Manx Radio newscast. You are obviously someone with exquisite taste. May I politely suggest you might want to subscribe to this and a wide range of Manx Radio podcasts at your favourite podcast provider, so our best bits will magically appear on your smartphone. Thank you.